Now, the end of the hour last time, we mentioned as number four here how God preserved a portion of English Puritanism and established a great new Christian center. This is the first time that I have ever dealt with this particular subject at this place in the history, because we are now looking back at some events that happened 80 years prior to the time that we've now reached. And usually I have given them at that particular point, chronologically. But I decided this year it was more logical to deal with them at this place, because they were events which at the time when they occurred were hardly noticed. They would seem to most people then to be of comparatively little importance. But it was their results that made them of tremendous importance. And I think we can better appreciate their importance when we see the situation first. And that's why I postponed it to this point. Yes?
Is that Roman before?
No, it is Arabic before. We're still under Great Britain in the last third, the last 40 years of this century, of the 17th century. We're still in that heading which was East, capital East. And under that, this is now 4. I mentioned it at the end of the hour. E was Great Britain from 1660 to 1700. 1, the reestablished the monarchy. 2, Scotland. 3, the destruction of Puritanism in England. 4, James II. Oh, and this would be 5. Right, 5. Thank you. I get my mathematics correct, as Mr. Paul said. Thank you very much. So number 5 is how God preserved a portion of English Puritanism and established a great new Christian center. This is, to my mind, one of the greatest illustrations in all history of God's working, providential. The way in which God works all things together in accordance with his purposes. And he sees the end from the beginning, and he knows what the results are going to be. Someone in a Puritan living in, most of the Puritans living in England in the early years of King James' reign, beginning of that century, saw things in difficulty. But they hoped that they would work their way out of the difficulty. Then they did. They struggled forward. They pushed forward. Eventually, they gained complete control. Now, we've noticed how when they gained complete control, we've noticed how it might be if either group, the large overwhelming majority, or the small but vocal fine section that gained control of the army, if either of these sections had been ready to work out a system of working with the other, perhaps it might have continued. But God knew the end from the beginning, and God knew it would not. And God knew before Protestantism ever entered England, God knew that Puritanism would be destroyed in England, and that by the year 1700, that England would be a country in which there was the gospel was available if a person wanted to listen closely to the words read in the church service, or wanted to read the Bible for himself, but that there would be no enthusiastic, energetic group pushing it and reaching any sizable portion of the English people with the knowledge of salvation. God knew that. And so God prepared in the most marvelous way ahead of time, so that a portion of English Puritanism would be preserved in a most unexpected way, and that a new great center would be established from which eventually the Word of God would be sent out to most of the sections of the world, and from which a tremendous, 200 years later, a tremendous missionary movement would reach out and have tremendous results on the whole world. Results which in recent years are largely being pushed into the background by the onrush of modernism all over the world. But there were tremendous results in God's economy from what seemed to most people just a comparatively small thing that happened early in this century. And I want to look at that thing, and I want to notice with you a little bit of the strange way God works. In order to see that a little bit, let's go back 50 years earlier yet. Let's go back to 1586. And in 1586, 2 years before the Spanish Armada attacked England, In that year, Mary, Queen of Scots, you remember, was in northern England, where she had been for 20 years in a castle there, enjoying a fair amount of freedom, but yet under strict guard. And she had been entering into plots to destroy Queen Elizabeth. And you remember that at that time, Elizabeth's counselors finally persuaded her that it was necessary that the menace to the peace of England, which Mary, Queen of Scots, plots and conspiracies, and even more, the fact that she was there and could take over and completely end Protestantism in England, this was a menace which must be dealt with. And many other people, for engaging in plots against Elizabeth's life, had been executed. And Elizabeth finally, very, very hesitantly, signed the paper that the decision of the High Court should be carried out and that Mary should be executed. But Elizabeth did not want any royal blood to be shed under any condition and was very much averse to doing it. Well, the man who persuaded her to sign her name to this paper granting that the High Court's decision be carried out was a man named Davison. And Mr. Davison, D-A-V-I-S-O-N, was a very earnest Puritan, a man who had been active in English government and was now one of the three or four top men in the government. And there seemed to be nothing, no end to the possibilities of advance for him in the future. Davison had, a few years before that, on his way north to Scotland to represent Queen Elizabeth, had gone to a town in northern England called Scrooby, a postal town, S-C-R-O-O-B-Y, a name which 150 years ago was completely unknown as far as American church historians were concerned, but which during the last 100 years has been well known in this area. But in this little town of Scrooby, as Davison stayed overnight, and he was attracted by the appearance and intelligence of the young son of the postmaster, named William Brewster. And so Davison had invited Brewster, who had had some time as a student at Cambridge, to come with him and join his, become one of his assistants. And young Brewster had left his home and gone with Davison. And then when Davison represented Queen Elizabeth in the Netherlands for some years, Brewster was with him there and soon became Davison's leading associate. And a great future seemed to be ahead for Davison and for Brewster. A future which became completely blasted and must have seemed to both of them a most terrible thing. It was blasted because when Davison took Queen Elizabeth's orders up to northern England and Mary, Queen of Scots, was executed, Elizabeth blamed the whole thing on Davison. She didn't want anybody to think that she had any part in slaying a queen. And so, a woman of royal blood. And so she, when he came back, she gave orders that he be imprisoned in the Tower of England, that he be deprived of all his positions in the government, and fined a substantial fine. She said, "It is true, I signed the order, but I did not give another order that it be carried out." And she said, consequently, he exceeded his authority in having it carried out. Well, he knew the risk he was running when he took the letter in the first place. But he felt, as the other Puritan leaders did, that Protestantism in England would probably be utterly destroyed if Mary, Queen of Scots, remained as a center for the efforts to make her queen instead of Elizabeth and to kill Elizabeth. And so he took the risk. Elizabeth made him stay in the prison only for a couple of years, but then she had him released, but his life was ended as far as any accomplishment in political life was concerned. And young Brewster had nothing to do but go back to Scrooby and assist his father. And when his father died a year later, the order was given that the postmastership be turned over to someone else rather than given to the son. Davison, however, after he got out of prison, managed to still have enough influence with some of the leaders to get young Brewster into his father's position. But here were two men whose lives seemed to have, these promising lives were ruined through something that wasn't their fault at all. It was Davidson's loyalty to what he thought was right that caused his life to come to an end as far as accomplishment was concerned. As far as Brewster was concerned, he was just caught in the circumstances which put an end to the marvelous future ahead of him. And all this fine training he'd had with his wonderful Puritan leader, Davidson, contact with the Christians in the Netherlands, and contact with the leaders of Elizabeth's government and of the government of the Netherlands. Now there was nothing for him but to be the postmaster of a small town in northern England, as far as any future was concerned. But God, who knows the end from the beginning, works all things together for his purposes, and Brewster's life accomplished far more for the Lord in the end than if he had gone on and become a political leader in England. Well, we move forward then through a number of years in which Brewster was quietly working there in the post office. And we just mentioned here now, in passing, a Puritan minister and his brother who took a separatist stand, and for this were thrown into prison by Queen Elizabeth. And just before 1600, they heard, they were told in the prison, that if they would volunteer to go to America and to try to establish a colony over there for Great Britain, they would be released from prison. And so they joined an expedition which left England to build a colony over in the New World. They started across. The captain and several members of the crew died, and the ship was left with nobody able to navigate it properly. A great wind blew it out of its course. Eventually, they were captured by pirates. Most of the people killed. The two ministers managed to make their way back to Europe and went to Holland and became leaders in the church there. But you can imagine from then on, they had no desire to try to cross the ocean again and think of establishing anything in America. Well, this man, Brewster, in Scrooby there, had a minister, a rector in the church, who gave wonderful Bible lessons. And Brewster, already knowing a great deal of the Bible, was tremendously impressed with this minister's lessons and followed on in his teaching. And the result was that when he left and went to another place, Brewster was dissatisfied with the failure of a real Christian teacher in his place, and went with some friends to a town a little ways away where there was another minister who gave a fine Bible lesson, and eventually persuaded him to come and hold meetings in Brewster's home, which was contrary to the laws of Queen Elizabeth. This was just about the end of Queen Elizabeth's reign. But Brewster and others held these meetings there. They were interfered with by the police from time to time, but they held these meetings, and they had a small church which eventually came to have about 100 people in it, a very enthusiastic, earnest Christian people, but constantly interfered with by the government. Now King James was king. They decided that they would try to leave England and go over to Holland. Go over to Holland, where there were other English groups that were meeting individuals. They found great difficulties in doing so. One time, they made an arrangement with a Dutch ship to carry them to Holland, which was, of course, strictly against the law. They made their way across England to the port where this ship would be. The women went by boat down the river. The men crossed by land. The women got across there and got onto the Dutch ship. The men were not quite there when the police suddenly appeared. And the Dutch captain was unwilling to wait and risk losing his ship, and the ship put off. And the result was that the men were seized and put into prison, and most of the women managed to make their way back to England eventually. The men were put into prison in a town called Boston, an English town called Boston, a town in which most of the people were Puritans. And so they were well treated. The people there favored them, but they had to obey King James's law. They were kept in prison some months before they finally were released. And one difficulty after another like this interfered, but eventually they made their way to Holland. And there in Amsterdam, they joined a local group of Christians, of English Christians, and there they heard about the this effort to make a found a colony in America, which had so utterly failed about 10 years before. Now for about 12 years, this group of English people lived in Holland. They were only one of a number of such groups in Holland. They lived a very brief time in Amsterdam, and then they got permission from the town of Leiden, that were down there, and set a town a few miles south of Amsterdam, a university town. And there, their beloved pastor, John Robinson, yes?
This is John Robinson, who was a minister of Baptist
Church. John Robinson, he had been, they called him the teacher, and maybe they had a pastor and a teacher, but now he was the pastor. John Robinson became active in the University of Leiden. He was able to give some instruction. He took an active part in the Calvinist-Arminian controversy which occurred at this time, and he was able to get along fairly well, being a highly trained man. But most of them had a very difficult time getting a living. They had to work 10, 12, 14 hours a day in order to get a bare living. They soon found that their children, they had no opportunity to have enough time with their children to bring them up the way they wanted to. Some of their young children ran off and joined the Dutch army. Others got into all kinds of things that they felt they never would have if the parents had the opportunity to bring them up the way they wanted to, instead of having to spend so much time in making a bare living. And they became dissatisfied there. And they began to say, would it be possible for us to find a place where we could live, where we could continue to be English instead of having everybody around us speaking Dutch and our children soon losing their identity as English-speaking people, and where we could arrange the conditions of life such that what we believe the Bible teaches would be the established law of the community, instead of there being all these influences to lead our children away from what we believe in, and where we could have our services as we feel that the Bible teaches we should have. Now, their ideas were a little different from almost any other of the Puritan groups. In fact, in later years, they had great difficulty finding ministers and eventually lost their identity as a separate group because they could not find leaders with their exact ideas. But they felt a great desire this way to get a place where they could establish a colony by themselves. And so they looked around and investigated what was the possibility of doing this. Well, just at that time, at about 1618, there was a group from Amsterdam of English who decided to try to come to the New World, and got in a boat, 180 people in the boat, and got through storms, came storms and pestilence and trouble, and blown out of their course, and when they eventually reached America, 130 of the 180 had died. And the rest were so discouraged that they found their way back to Amsterdam, and these folks met them and heard what their experience was. And humanly speaking, it was practically impossible that they should succeed in what they wanted to do. About 10 years ago, maybe 15, I remember, the Saturday Evening Post came out with a copy of its magazine in November, and on the front, a great big letter that said, "Let's have no more nonsense about the pilgrims." And it said this was their Thanksgiving Day issue, and they referred to an article in the magazine, which was written by someone who said, "This was very foolish, all the fuss we make about the pilgrims." They said the pilgrims were a little group of ignorant people, the religious fanatics with some peculiar ideas, a very small group of them. They were not the first to come over here. The author of the article said, "My own ancestors were living in Maine a long time before these pilgrims came. In fact, they received letters from friends of England asking them, as they were busy in fishing and so on, to look in on these poor people down in Massachusetts and see if they could give them any help and keep them from dying out." And actually, this little group that came over there was really of no importance. Why all this fuss about the pilgrims? Well, it was a good way to sell copies of the magazine, to have an article that was contrary to the great stress that has been laid in American schools through the years on the coming of the pilgrim. But it's good to have the question raised. Just what difference did it make that a little group of people like this, of mostly uneducated people, without much special training or background, were able to get over here and to establish a little colony as they did? Actually, they're not the first Protestant group to try to establish a colony over here. I believe that some French Huguenots established one at Recife in Brazil, and then the Portuguese from Rio, I believe, had come up there and had destroyed them. Then there was a group of French Huguenots in the 16th century that established a colony in what is now St. Augustine, Florida. And the Spanish group attacked them and killed every one of them and put a sign on the tree in which they said, "We do not kill these people because they are Frenchmen, but because they are Huguenots." But it was not the first English colony in America. A few years before the pilgrims came, the English had founded Jamestown in Virginia in honor of King James. And there were about 400 people who came to Jamestown. 5 years later, the colony had dropped to where it had less than 200 people in it. When Lord Delaware came over here with equipment and provisions and new colonists to try to build up further the colony in Virginia, just as he came near, he met a ship going out, which all the people left in the town had packed up what they had gotten in the ship, planning to go back to England and abandon them. But he met them just as they were starting and brought them back, and the colony did continue. But there was a colony there in Jamestown, in Virginia. Now, why should this little group of pilgrims be of much importance? Well, of course, one reason is that this was not a royal venture. The king and his power was back of building a camp in a colony in Jamestown. These were just a little group of humble Christians, and humanly speaking, they never possibly could have succeeded in their endeavor if it were not for marvelous providential intervention that God made. Of course, another reason they wanted to leave Holland was because it looked as if war was imminent again, as it did break out, the 30 Years' War, and because the King of England had heard of some of the Puritan booklets that were being printed by William Brewster in Holland and being smuggled into England. And so they had sent representations to the Dutch government to have Brewster seized and sent to England for trial. And when they came to Brewster's house to get him, they couldn't find him. He was at that time in disguise in England, distributing his pamphlets. But this narrow escape that he had made them realize that they'd be a lot safer if they got further away from the power of the King of England than there. And so they, how could this little group that could hardly sustain itself there, how could they get across the sea, way across to where it would take more than 2 months on a boat to reach it, if you had good fortune and good weather, at least 9 weeks it would take. How could they get sufficient support to get across? Well, they managed to find some adventurers, as they called them, in England. That is, people who would put up the money in to be paid back over a period of years. Then they had to get royal permission, and they went to see King James. And if you remember, that is one of their men in England who was ready to represent them there. And King James, you remember, was he was changeable at times. And he was very politic, very careful. He wasn't like his son, who just brutally pushed forward on what he wanted done. King James heard, here's a group of people would like to found an English colony over the New World, another English colony. Well, James said, how will they support themselves? Well, he said, by fishing. Well, he said, that's a good calling. That was the apostles' own. And King James was in a good mood that day, and he gave permission that they should be allowed to found the colony in America. Now, the pilgrims did not want to come to Virginia, because in Virginia, the laws were very strict. All the people in the colony had to attend the regular services of the church. There were 2 services held every day at which attendance was compulsory. And a person who missed one service had to pay a heavy fine. If he missed 2 services, he had a time in prison. A man who missed two Sunday services was in prison for a long time, and if he missed three Sunday services, he was executed. And while they had the hope that they could be allowed more religious freedom over here than in England, if they were at all near Virginia, who knows whether King James's rules might be extended by himself or by a successor. But of course, the further you get away from Virginia, southward, the nearer you get to Florida, where the Spanish were, who had destroyed the Huguenots in St. Augustine. And the farther you go north from Virginia, the colder it gets, and the more difficult for people without good equipment to survive. And so, John Smith, who had been the leader in the colony in Virginia, was no longer a leader, wrote the Pilgrims and offered to be their captain and to help them, and he had explored the country up to what we now call New England. But they decided that he wasn't the type of man they wanted in their group, so they did not accept his offer. But they started from there and found that, Robinson said, now, he said, of the group here, if the majority of you are going now, I'll go with you. But he said, if the majority votes not to go with the first group, then I'll stay in Holland and go with the second group. And the majority voted to stay, not to go with the first party. So they filled up the ranks of the ship from other people of like mind from England, who joined them in England. But Robinson said goodbye to those who left over there, and he said, I believe that God has yet more truth to break from his word. Gave them a wonderful message. They had grand letters from him, but he died within the next 2 years. So he never got to America as he had hoped. Well, they had difficulty with their two boats, the Speedwell and the Mayflower, and eventually they had to give up the Speedwell and crowd into the Mayflower. They had about 100 people plus the crew, and the crew of profane, cursing sailors was constantly ridiculing them on the way over, and they found that the most disagreeable feature of the trip. God gave them good weather. There was no pestilence. One person died on the way over, and one baby was born on the way over. So they arrived with a whole number, exactly the same number as had left England. But the delays in getting the boat in shape meant that they arrived as winter was coming on, which of course was a very difficult thing. Now, one thing occurred that they knew nothing about. If they had come 4 years early, and if they had come to New England 4 years early, they would hardly have lived, lasted 3 or 4 months. Because 4 years earlier, that area was filled with Indians, very powerful and very pugnacious Indians. And no matter how they tried to get along with them, with the number that was there and the tribal wars among them, the Indian group, no matter how they tried to get along, they would certainly have been wiped out within a few months. As it was, they had a tough time to survive. So they tried to get along with the Indians, and they did very well. Yet other Englishmen came in the neighborhood who were of bad character, and the Indians decided to wipe them out, and they said, well, if we do, then the Pilgrims will turn upon us to defend their own people, so we've got to wipe them out too. And on two or three occasions, it was only by almost a miracle that they survived. But if they had come 4 years earlier, there would have been 10 times as many Indians there. And during those 4 years, there was a great pestilence which swept off thousands of those Indians. And, of course, God knew that at this time that there would be so many less than at a previous time. The Pilgrims knew nothing about it. And it was a part of the providential leading that they should survive. Well, they wanted to get as far away from Virginia as they could, and so they directed them up to this part of New England. And when they arrived there, along in November, it was getting very cold. And they spent nearly a month hunting for a decent place to make their colony, moving back and forth along the shore. So it was in December when they finally started to make their colony there. And during that winter, half of them died of disease. Some of the time, practically all of them were sick. And it was looked like a very poor start for building a colony there. How would they survive in country where they had no special talents, no special abilities or skills? They didn't know what kind of plants would grow there, what kind of food you could find there that would be good. Would they have to, by trial and error, decide what was poison and what was safe, and what would grow and what wouldn't, and what kind of animals or fish or eels or different things they could use and what kind they couldn't, and so on. So they knew nothing about all these various things. And humanly speaking, if it were not for God's providence, they never could have survived. There were other people up in Maine who were making a precarious existence with fishing, perhaps having a good season, getting some money and things ahead, but not the type at all like these people. And they were people who were trained for the particular type of work that they were doing. Well, the next spring came. During the winter, they made little exploratory trips when they were well enough to, around near the place where they planned to make their settlement. And they'd make these exploratory trips, and occasionally they would see evidence there had been Indians around, but only about two or three times the whole winter did they get a glimpse of any Indians. One time they saw some distance away, and these Indians turned toward them and shot some arrows, but did not hit them. They didn't know the Indian language. They knew no way to talk with them anyway. How would they persuade them? They wanted to be peaceful. They weren't there to destroy them. They just had no contact with Indians through the winter. And then the next spring, one day, an Indian came walking into their place where they had built a few houses. And he came walking down the main street. And they saw this Indian walking down the main street, and they didn't know what he was going to do. And he walked up to their headquarters, and he turned, a couple of them stepped out. They didn't want him to come in there, so they knew for sure something about him. He says, me Samoset, me want beer. Well, he knew a little English. And so they talked with him. They found he was an Indian from Maine who was down on a brief visit down there. And he told them that he would come back the next day and bring another Indian with him who knew much more English than he did. He was on a brief visit and going back to Maine. The next day he came again, and he brought another Indian with them. And now we see the most marvelous instance of the Lord's providence. Another case where a man's life seemed to be ruined, but God was using it for his purpose. About 6 or 7 years before, at the place where the pilgrims made their settlement at Plymouth, there had been a very large and prosperous Indian village. And an English ship had stopped at that place, where Captain Hunt, the captain of the ship, had begun trading with the Indians and had made friendly relations with the Indians in this colony. And then one day, he said, would some of you young fellows like to see our ship, see what it's like? And so about 10 of these young Indians came out to his ship and got inside, and they showed them all around the ship. And then when they were ready to leave, the sailors seized them and tied them up. And the ship sailed over to Spain and sold these 10 Indians as slaves in Spain. And one of these 10, who was a slave in Spain for some time, managed to escape from Spain and to make his way to England. And there in London, he became acquainted with a well-to-do Englishman who received him into his home and who treated him well, and he learned to speak English excellently and learned a great deal about England. In fact, this Quanto, when they told him postulant, they found he knew the streets of England far better than the streets of London, far better than any of them did. And he not only knew England and the English language, but he knew the Indian language, and he knew the land there. He knew the customs. He knew what crops could be grown, how to grow them, what was good to eat, what was dangerous, all the things that they needed to know to get established here, Squanto knew. Well, Squanto had told the Englishman how he'd like to get back home and see his friends and see his fiance there in the village and so on. And the Englishman had some ships he owned, and one of them was coming over and brought Squanto and dropped him off there in Massachusetts, and Squanto found just an empty place where everybody in this town where he had lived was dead from the pestilence that had taken everyone away within the previous couple of years before he got back. And so he had been there 2 or 3 months. Everybody he knew was gone. But there were other Indians a few miles away who were left, whom he knew, but with whom he had no close ties at all. And now Samoset brought Squanto to the Pilgrims, and Squanto, after a little, decided to live with the Pilgrims and to help them. And without his help, humanly speaking, this expedition just would have utterly failed. Many another effort to colonize with the power of a royal, with the royal power back of it from some European nation had failed, had been unable so far across the sea to get a settlement started that would endure. And this one, with the terrible cold in the winter there and with the difficulty there, it nevertheless survived, partly because God provided Squanto to help it. About 6 months later, a group of Indians seized Squanto and took him away. They said, "We take away their tongues, and they can't get along, because without Squanto to interpret, there'd be no way they could deal with the Indians." But a group of pilgrims went and rescued Squanto. However, he lived about a year or two, and then he was taken with a fever and died. But during this time, he was able to give them the information that made it possible for them to survive. Well, it is interesting to see the many ways in which God providentially interfered in order to enable this little group of humble people to continue. They found that they had new groups coming. It's interesting thing that the next year a boat came and brought them some more pilgrims to them. And this new group that came, but when they first came, of course, they had taken a lot of beer with them, because in England, that's what they all drank, was beer. They wouldn't think of drinking just ordinary water. Why, they wouldn't do that. Even when I was a student in Germany, a great many people thought it was dangerous to drink water. It had to drink some kind of a fruit juice or an alcoholic thing or something. Well, this was weak beer, I guess, that they used, but that was what they were accustomed to drinking. But they ran out of their beer. And so they had to drink water, and after a little, they got to where they enjoyed it. And then the new ship came, and the new group of pilgrims came and joined them, and they had a stock of beer they brought with them, and they were afraid, if we divide our beer up with these folks already there, it won't last so long. And to their surprise, they found that the pilgrims had lost their taste for beer. They were now used to drinking good fresh water and preferred it. And so the new pilgrims who came, they carefully saved their beer, keeping it among themselves and using it till it ran out, and they had to start drinking water, and soon they lost their taste for beer. And that's the way that America became a place in which there was much more water drinking than there had been in European countries. What they did have, they had one or two times when someone would come and would make friends with the different people and try to stir them up against the leaders and get the organization changed. Several times they had to send people back to England who had caused trouble like that. The first couple of years they had difficulty growing enough food. They found that at the beginning of each year they would take the land near where their settlement was, and they would divide it into plots, and they would give each family a certain plot, depending on the size of the family. And they'd say, for this year, that's your plot. Now you should work that and grow all you can and bring it in to the center, and we'll have all the food here, and then we'll divide it up, and we'll give each one what they need. And each year, when they had used up a greater part of their food, they got to where they were just having to live on what they could find, or berries they could pick and so on, until the new harvest came in, because they didn't have enough to last them through. And then they said, let's change the organization. Instead of being from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs, we will give plots out this time, and these are your permanent possessions. And what you can draw on them now, you don't have to bring in. You must bring in a certain amount. But whatever you get beyond that is yours. And to their surprise, even these fine Christian people who were all so interested in the success of the cause, Governor Bradford tells you in his diary how to their amazement they found that all the families got out and worked far harder than they ever had before. And they worked hard and they built up their, they produced all they could, and that year they had enough to get to the harvest and have quite a little left over that they could use to trade with Indians and others and get things they could send to England to pay on the toward the cost of their coming over. And so even if the communist system would ever work, it would work among fine Christian people, all devoted to the success of the enterprise. And yet there they found that with a free enterprise system, that it was so far more successful. But after they continued for about 8 years there, and were pretty much alone. And then the thing happened that was the real reason why the coming of the pilgrims was important. This little group of pilgrims had been determined that they must worship God the way they felt the Bible taught, and they must have a community in which this law would be the law of all the life of the community, and they were willing to hazard their all for it. But the great bulk of the Puritans in England felt, well, things are going to get better eventually, we'll just hang on, and eventually we'll get a king who will be more friendly, or something will happen that makes an improvement. And after all, there's getting to be more of us all the time, and those who were pretty dissatisfied with the restrictions of the government would say, well, that's all, what could we do? We couldn't away over there, 9 weeks trip on a boat over there to a shore where there's none of the things we have here. But then when they began to hear that this little group of 100 originally, and then another 100 joined them later, of poor people were able to succeed and to establish a community that would survive and continue and get on its feet, they began to say, well, now, maybe we'd be better off to be over there than to have the restrictions and the problems of carrying on our life here the way we would like to. And so, beginning of about between 1628 and 1630, there was a group of people who left and decided to come over and to form a community called Salem, the first one. And when they left England, they looked back at England, and they said, we are separating not from the Church of England, but from its corruption, from its error. And they hated to leave England, and they hated to leave their church connections over there, but they wanted to follow the scripture as they felt it should be, and it was the example of the Puritans, of the pilgrims, that led these Puritans to decide to do it. And between 1630 and 1640, in 10 years, about 40,000 Puritans left England. And the whole town came over. That they would have people who were trained in different arts and skills and different things that were important to carry on life in England. The pilgrims had hardly anybody there. But whole towns with all the different vocations and the different types of preparation and knowledge that was necessary, and some of them people with considerable capital, and a good many of them people who were educated in the universities of Great Britain, came over in order to establish colonies in the neighborhood of where the pilgrims had established their call. The pilgrims were unable to get ministers that held exactly their view, and eventually they were absorbed by these other colonies. And the other colonies, on the other hand, though they had no thought of making as complete a break as the pilgrims had, being so far away, eventually they became, each of them, an independent church for itself, but with various congregational assemblies and organizations in which they sent representatives and for mutual cooperation. And thus the congregational churches of New England area became established in these 10 years. And then 1640 came, and the Parliament stood up against the king, and it looked as if the Puritans would get control, and the migration stopped. And you had about 40,000 between 1630 and 1640. You probably didn't have 400 who came between 1640 and 1660. In that, it stopped completely. The because they were getting control of England. And why should they leave all the good things of an established country to go over there to that howling wilderness over there and try to survive when they were getting things in a proper religious condition in England? And so it stopped them. But this group that came over here, the pilgrims led the way. And they never could have if God had not so providentially and so marvelously led. And so God knew from beforehand, God knew that during the next 50 years, Puritanism would be completely wiped out of England. A few little struggling groups would survive without having much influence in England. And as this great, tremendous movement would have come to an end as far as England was concerned. And from 1700 on, England was sunk into the perhaps the most degenerate condition for a time that the country has ever been in before or since. But there survived this center over here in which the ideas of the Puritans were being carried forward and which a life was being established, which eventually gave a color and an attitude to the whole of a new and growing nation, which God used as a great center for the sending of the gospel throughout the world. And I think it is one of the most marvelous instances of the wonderful providential activity of the Lord. I think it means much more to us to look at it now after we see what happened in England during those years than to look at it chronologically at the time when it occurred, when neither the pilgrims nor anybody else realized just how important it was, or what difference it could make, or what it could cause, what it could bring about. Now these other groups came over and became established there, and it's interesting that 150 years ago, nobody knew where the pilgrims had come from. But somebody was reading in an English, in a book on the history of Massachusetts that had been written quite early, in which the man quoted from Governor Bradford's diary, his account of Plymouth Plantation. And they saw these references, but they didn't have any copy of Bradford's book. And they didn't know the name of the place they'd come from or anything about it. But they saw this, and then an American about 100 years ago picked up a book written in England, which dealt with the history of colonization in America. And he found in it a couple of paragraphs, which were exactly identical to the paragraphs in this book in America, which it said were taken from Bradford's diary. And he said, how did this man in England get a hold of it? Especially if there were some more paragraphs that he didn't have. And so he went and made an investigation and found that during the Revolutionary War, some British soldiers picked up Bradford's diary and took it back with him to England. And it was in the library of one of the bishops in England, where it remained for nearly 100 years. And then it was found. And in his diary, it tells us all of these details about Quanto and about the establishment and where they come from and all this. So now we have this information and we see just how God works in this way to preserve a portion of English Puritanism and establish a great new Christian center. Now that finishes Roman numeral 6. So we will make Roman numeral 7 be the 18th century. 6 was the 17th century. 7 will be the 18th century. And under this, A will be conditions at the beginning of the century. Conditions at the beginning of the 18th century. Scotland freed from the killing time. Scotland lost far more people than England did during the persecution. But in Scotland, the blood of the martyrs was, in a real way, the seed of the church. The church was reestablished in Scotland. Though many of its leaders had been killed, they were not in a strong condition, but they were reestablished and strongly loyal to the Westminster Confession. In England, the Puritanism had been just about annihilated, and the great body of people were sunk in sodden and alcoholism and sunk in sin. The condition was a very, very low condition. But they had freedom now. The toleration had come in with King William coming. Then when Queen Anne became queen, she tried to swing back, but it was pretty hard to swing back. And she reigned from 1702 to 1714. And after her death, the toleration again became what had been under William. They were free to carry on religious life as they desired, but nobody desired anymore, except a few people who were called the non-jurors. And the non-jurors were some fine, earnest, high-quality people in the Church of England who felt very keenly their oath to be true to the king. And when King James was driven out, they felt that this was wrong. And they're non-jurors because they refused to take the oath to King William. And they began a movement against the immorality and wickedness of the church. It didn't go very far. But they were about the only group of any real light during this period. And then God brought a new movement from an entirely different direction, which we'll look at next week.